Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everybody. This is Stephen Carter, and I'm gonna stop apologizing for myself now. I think I've demonstrated that I'm pretty fascinating. Though, I pray every bit as fervently as you do that we'll have our beloved John Larson back into rotation soon. Today's episode is the first in a series I'm hoping to do intermittently over the next year or so that I've tentatively titled Forgotten Mormons. As I've watched discussions happening on the various blogs, Facebook groups, and podcasts, I've noticed that some of the most interesting figures in Mormonism's past have disappeared from the conversation. It's not that our current crop of Mormons hasn't produced some fascinating people. I just think that we'd be even more interesting if we remembered to stand on the shoulders of these past giants. The people we'll be covering are ones who built something that the larger world recognized as valuable, and they did it using some of the building blocks Mormonism gave them. And they're going to be people that, if you're 35 years or younger, you're 99% likely to have never heard of. They're going to be people whose ideas or works will simultaneously blow your mind and feel familiar. So, the first person in this series is named Wayne Booth. Now, I'm a huge fan of Wayne's. His book, My Many Selves, The Quest for a Plausible Harmony, is one of my top five autobiographies, and it would actually be difficult for me to come up with what the other four would be. However, I'm only a Wayne Booth fanboy, and I have little to offer besides my excitement. So I have with me here today Greg Clark and John Ogden. Thank you both for being willing to be a part of my hero worship today.
Thanks for letting me in.
My pleasure.
So, Greg, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why you're one of the most perfect people to have on this episode.
I teach at BYU in the English department. I studied rhetoric and communication in a PhD program in at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute many years ago, and it was there that I immersed myself in rhetoric as a field of study, and also I learned as a way of viewing the world. It was through my mentors there that I met Wayne for the first time, although when I was an undergraduate at BYU, I remember going to hear him talk. As soon as he found out I was from Utah, he asked me if I was a member of the church, and I said yes, and he immediately started probing me about matters that were concerning to him, about how to deal with the contradictions he felt about his faith, how to manage what I think was his lifelong struggle with essentially giving up his own authority to prophetic authority. I think that was his issue with the church.
That's interesting.
And as a result, he always claimed he was a member of the church. He always identified as a member of the church. I always knew him very obviously as a member of the church, but he was in no way orthodox. In a lot of ways, I think he practiced and preached the true essentials. But I made his work a matter of study, became friends with him, became pretty close friends with him, much to my surprise. One of the blessings he brought to my life is that although he was older than my parents, he was 30 years older, 29 years older than I am, he always treated me like a peer. And I noticed he did that with a lot of people. His conversations were always bilateral. There was no hierarchy, and he listened as much as he spoke. Regarding his life, My Many Selves, I was asked by the Utah State University Press to be a reader on the manuscript, and I saw some problems in terms of, you know, being kind of fair to the church and members of the church. And so I just called him up and talked to him about it. And by that time, he was 6 months away from his death. And I think he may have known it was coming because he just said, okay, thanks. Yeah. All right. I'll do it. Yeah. And not very enthusiastically. But then after his death, his family, there was a memorial service in Chicago, and then quite a small one in a ward chapel in Alpine, where he's buried. And they asked me to read a poem that somebody had brought to the Chicago memorial service by Stephen Spender. Its first line is, "I think continually of those who were truly great." I went home from that to tell my wife that I don't know exactly what follows this life, but I want to go where Wing is.
Well, I guess that's one more reason for me to look forward to the next life. So John, what about you?
I found Wayne Booth when I was an undergraduate at BYU studying English, and I would say that he likely single-handedly was the reason that I chose to study a master's or get a master's degree at BYU after that. I just was really captivated with his writing and his ideas, and I ended up writing my master's thesis on his term rhetorology, which Greg Clark chaired, and I appreciated that. Since then, I wrote a book called When Mormons Doubt, and it's a way to strengthen relationships when we disagree about belief. And I would say that nobody influenced me more in writing the book than Wayne Booth, and I pulled overtly and covertly from him more than anyone else as I wrote it. I can't claim to be a Wayne Booth expert by any stretch, but I am definitely highly enthusiastic about what he says. And I could say that I'm an amateur, and I would think that, in a sense, Wayne Booth, he doesn't seem to disdain that term at all. In fact, he wrote a book about being an amateur, doing things for the love of it, even if you're not an expert, and said how important that was to living a good life. And so I feel confident in saying I'm a Wayne Booth amateur in the best sense.
Excellent. I hope that I can become one of those, too. So I'm going to ask the most important question first, because it's going to be the question that every single listener is going to be asking as soon as I finish this next sentence. And here's that next sentence. Wayne Booth is a rhetorician. Now, guys, why should our listeners not push the button that takes them to their favorite Beyoncé fan podcast right now? Why in the world should they be interested in hearing about a rhetorician?
When I was studying rhetoric, while I was working on a PhD, people would say, "What are you studying?" And I'd say rhetoric. And they'd say, "What's rhetoric?" And I'd start to explain, and Linda, my wife, would be standing next to me. And after 30 seconds, she'd just push me to the side and said, "Let me explain." Because I knew my explanation made no sense at all. But Wayne's definitions make sense. Let me read you a couple of them. Rhetoric should be understood as the whole range of arts, not only of persuasion, but of producing or reducing misunderstanding. Another one is the art of mediating between your own views and the world, and the art of discovering in your circumstances what the possibilities for transformation are, including the possibilities of your own increased understanding. And there are other very pithy definitions. Of course, it's about communication. And of course, rhetoric is the name we give to communication that has either the intention or the effect or both of influencing others. Most of the time, people think of rhetoric as either logical persuasion, systematic argument, or manipulation. Skillful manipulation. And that's why it has a bad name, and it has had a bad name ever since the term was coined in ancient Greece. But what Wayne points out is that rhetoric is really a matter of relationship. It's the name for what happens when people who are different, as we all are different, try through their communication to find what Wayne talked about as common ground. Try to find where they can find a place to cooperate, to get along, maybe to progress together. I'm teaching class right now on rhetorical theory, and what I find myself saying is that Wayne Booth's understanding of rhetoric is that it's really what we do when we participate in dialogue with other people. Rhetoric can be used as a weapon It can be used as a weapon in a game that has to do only with somebody winning. But it also can be used as the medium of cooperation by which people who are required by their circumstances to cooperate, that's how they negotiate the cooperation.
I'll add that Wayne Booth used the term rhetoricry. He said that that was when you used rhetoric to obfuscate and to persuade in negative ends. And he said that his project was the exact opposite of that. And I agree. I think that the reason that you should be interested in listening to Wayne Booth is that he teaches how to follow the great commandment of loving your neighbor as yourself. I think that that will be revealed throughout this conversation. He keeps pointing back to the idea of love through dialogue. And once we have our basic needs met, there's really nothing else more important than that in life, in my opinion.
You know, I would say that Wayne, from among many, many people who have been participants in the Restoration, he's one of the relative few, I think, who has continuously and insistently focused on the principle that I think is fundamental to the Restoration, and that is we are all one. We're all interdependent and in this together. And if we would just figure it out, we would discover that we're intended to live in harmony and we're equipped to live in harmony with each other. And all of the conflict and all of the contention that characterizes our experience is not the reality. And so Wayne's work insists on what he considers the fact that in most every case, not all probably, because there is, he wouldn't have said this, but I will, there is actual evil that we encounter. But in most cases, people can work it out and come together, and that is an eternal principle that we are capable of and intended to come together. And that's his faith. If you read his work, you find that his leap of faith is from the contentious world we live in to the insistence that we are capable of rising above that contention and working things out if we believe we can and keep trying, and we are each sufficiently humble in the sense of being willing to acknowledge ways in which we're wrong and ways in which we can learn from each other.
It's true. He wrote something once about how rhetoric inevitably leads to religion, and you can kind of see that in his background. From what he wrote in My Many Selves, it sounds like what you two have been talking about is sort of rooted in his past, in what he experienced in growing up, and what he experienced on his mission, especially. It's kind of funny to see how much his mission affected what he said, which got the attention of so many in the world. So he started out, he was born in Provo, right? And then...
Born in American Fork.
Oh, okay.
On a little farm. Apparently his parents were Orthodox, but not blind followers. So he had a little critical edge. And then he came to BYU and got influenced by faculty who really shaped the rest of his life, like P.A. Christensen and others who were critical thinkers about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Not skeptical thinkers, but critical thinkers.
Ooh, that's something we should tease out later, the difference between critical and skeptical. Keep going.
Well, you started the story about his mission. Do you want to continue?
So if you read his autobiography, his life, he called it, you see a guy who lives most of his youth as a very Orthodox member of the church, so Orthodox that he, like, crosses the street when he comes up to the only non-Mormon meeting house in American Fork so that he doesn't have to walk past it. But then, as Greg was pointing out, in late high school and college, he sort of meets the rest of the world, and his Mormon worldview comes down. The church's truth claims dissolved for him, as far as I could tell. But the difficulty was that everyone he loves or is connected to is some kind of Mormon. And then he reaches the age where he's expected to go on a mission. And this is actually where we get to one of my favorite parts in My Many Selves, where Wayne paints this scene where he's irrigating BYU's crops while he's reading Plato. And one of his professors, Professor Polson, I think, drives up and they start to talk. And Wayne comes clean about his lack of faith in the church and how he's thinking about just leaving it all together. And then he's got this little quote in the book. The professor says, "Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. You keep leaping ahead into areas you know nothing about. The fact that some church leaders are dishonest doesn't mean that the church is valueless. Every institution, including every church, has some dishonest leaders. Surely you're not going to relapse into saying that because the church claims to be divinely led and its leaders are clearly not divine, it must be valueless when judged in human terms." And Wayne jumps in and says, "No, but I don't see any reason to." And then his professor jumps in and says, "You shouldn't be looking only for reasons to. You should be looking only for genuine reasons not to. Here you are, raised in a marvelously vital, generous-spirited tradition, surrounded by an astonishing number of virtuous, intelligent people whose church has helped them to find ways of living effectively. Then you come along and ask them for reasons to do what they're doing. What you should ask for, before giving up anything they offer you, is really sound reasons against going along." So it's an interesting way to frame the problem, because it's kind of an anthropological view. Anthropologists, they watch and they analyze a culture, seeing what kind of knowledge and behavior is stored in its myths and its roles and its social norms. And they say, yep, that's what this culture does. This is how it helps these people live in this environment. Most of the time, they don't spend any time wondering if the culture is perfect. They just look at how it functions. And so I think Wayne's professor is right. Mormonism functions. For the most part, it produces successful people. You can see that success in our history and in the present. It gives the adherents useful tools. But this is a difficult point for anyone who goes through a faith crisis, like Wayne did, like a lot of us do, to come to, since part of the church's function is to talk about itself as being the only true and living, etc., and your identity is often based on that. So it's not just the church coming down. It's your identity. But it seems to me like Wayne is showing us a completely different way to look at it. Mormonism provides all kinds of tools that have helped a whole bunch of people. What's here that's useful to you? And what can you do to maintain the kind of community where other people can benefit from those tools? And that's kind of what Wayne did. He just used those Mormon tools in ways and on subjects that no one in American Fork would have ever thought of.
Let me also add to that what happened to him on his mission.
Yeah.
And the story he tells is that he did enough resolving of the issues that he had prior to his discussion with his professor Polson that he did go on a mission. He ended up going to Chicago. And I think Polson's words to him had put into his consciousness the seed of what later became a Boothian doctrine that he developed at greatest length in his book, Modern Dogma and the Rhetoric of Assent. That principle, that doctrine, is that we should agree to assent, these are his words, to what we cannot in good faith seriously doubt. Put another way, he tried to persuade his readers and his students that the primary act of human beings is to assent to truth rather than to detect error. You know, that's not what we usually think of as critical thinking, but that for him was a more productive and humane sort of critical thinking. But the dilemma he faced while he was on a mission was that he, having grown up in American Fork and then having come of age in the highly sophisticated world of Provo in 1938 or so, he was teaching the doctrines of the church as a missionary and found out that the people he was teaching, who cared enough to talk to him, were every bit as thoroughly committed to their own way of understanding the world and way of understanding the divine as he was. And there was no contact being made in terms of mutual understanding. So out of that came his tendency to develop ideas later, such as what he calls listening rhetoric. He didn't teach rhetoric as production of discourse so much as he taught listening rhetoric, which is rhetoric as a dialogue, and really listening. And he describes really listening in the term that John kind of taught me a lot about, because John focused his thesis on this, what he called rhetorology, one of Wayne's terms that didn't really get a lot of traction beyond his own work. But what he means is that, in his words, is the systematic probing for common ground. So if you think about our current discourse in American society right now, that's not happening. That doesn't happen. And if it did happen, things might get a little better. There are people who aren't willing to do that, because if you're systematically probing someone else, finding common ground, that means you have to change as much as you're hoping they will change. Short of that, all you're doing with rhetoric is beating people up with it. And that's why rhetoric has a bad name.
There's a Sunstone article where he talks about his missionary experience that had a pretty profound impact on me. It's where I found the best definition of rhetorology, which Greg cited, and which, one thing I'll add to that definition, is that you risk the possibility of converting to the enemy camp. That line, for some reason, really has stuck with me. Whenever you're engaged in true dialogue, you risk conversion. And that's a very vulnerable state to be in, and that's why it gets to the concept of love. Because if we really have our heart in that place, that we're willing to concede, then we have fully opened up to the possibility of loving another human being.
And this isn't just Wayne. You can trace some of this back to Plato in the Phaedrus. You can trace it to, for example, a recent discovery I've made of the physicist David Bohm, B-O-H-M. He has a book called On Dialogue, where he tries to do a scientist's version of a dialogue laboratory. But all of these things require you to be willing to put everything, including your principles, including your certainties, on the table for trial. In the sense, as you listen to someone else and learn from someone else, you can always pick them back up again, but you may find that you need to change them. And the key word that Wayne uses gets transformation. And that connects back to his relationship with Kenneth Burke, who saw what we really do with rhetoric is influence each other's sense of identity. And a transformation of identity is becoming a new person, which has its own spiritual resonance.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of something I read from Parker Palmer. He calls the classroom a place where people enter into troth, like that old medieval word, I give you my troth. And he defines troth as when one person enters a covenant with another, a pledge to engage in a mutually accountable and transforming relationship, a relationship forged of trust and faith in the face of unknowable risks. To know in truth is to allow oneself to be known as well, to be vulnerable to the challenges and changes any true relationship brings. If you're going to go into a real conversation, into an actually productive rhetorical situation, if you don't come out changed, you did it wrong. Is that about right? Or am I reading too much into that?
Oh, I think that's about right. I mean, if you're genuinely listening to someone else and genuinely willing to find common ground in what someone else says, even if it's someone you think you agree with, you're going to come out changed because nobody else is the same. Well, he calls this progress. You know, this is the way we progress individually and together. He calls it, in one place, engaging together in acts of mutual persuasion that really amount to mutual inquiry. And that's what he sees is, you know, one of the major purpose of what we do when we live as humans with other humans.
This is why Wayne Booth appeals to me so much, is because I've spent a great deal of my life either as a teacher or watching people have dialogue with each other. One of the favorite parts of my life was when I was the teacher of the teaching teachers to teach class in Sunday school. I was the Sunday school president at the time, and I really enjoyed talking with those people because I was able to start using some of Wayne's theories to start getting us to have these conversations. And I've gone through some really rough patches with the church recently, but that hasn't shaken my faith that getting together with people the way Mormons do in a Sunday school or Relief Society or priesthood classroom is probably one of the most potent places that we have to build Zion by being vulnerable and open to each other. And instead of coming together to, you know, uphold a particular idea, that's usually what happens. They say, today we're getting together to talk about, you know, why we should follow the prophet. Instead of upholding a predetermined value, being able to come together and build value as a community where you not only end up with a value, but you end up with a relationship. That's why I keep going back, is because I'm kind of addicted to that possibility that we could possibly be doing what it is we've been talking about here.
Well, I just was struck by your reference to Zion. This is where we make Zion. And I realized as you said that, that this is what always attracted me to Wayne. Wayne didn't go to church that often in Chicago. He has a cabin in Wildwood in Provo Canyon, and Wildwood has a branch. I think they basically had a Sunday school that they did, maybe a sacrament meeting, I'm not sure. And he would go to that, and he would sometimes teach Sunday school. Otherwise, he didn't participate in the church. He didn't certainly didn't do the things you have to do to have a temple recommend. But his whole worldview, as he articulated it in his work, and to his great credit, he lived what he articulated, or tried to as much as he could. It's all about Zion. I hadn't given it that word till you said that, Stephen. But this oneness, being one, the kind of oneness he's talking about is the kind of oneness that's Zion.
So this reminds me of a section in the New Testament when Jesus talks about being perfect and loving your neighbor. And he says, you've heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. And is it okay if I just read the rest of this?
Why not? It's scripture. Go for it, man.
Okay. He says, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven, for he makes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. And in Mormonism and in many other religions, this gets quoted as saying you need to be completely without sin. But in context of these verses, that's not at all what it's talking about. It's talking about God sends his rain on the evil and the good. God sends the sun on the evil and the good, the just and the unjust. As God does that, you should too love perfectly. You should love your neighbor and you should love your enemy. And that is really the message that is being conveyed here. And in my opinion, that's what Wayne Booth is getting at through his ideas. He's saying that it's not enough just to love your neighbors. You also have to do the very difficult work of learning to love your enemies. And what's so compelling about Wayne Booth is that he's talking about this not on the community level, which is the practice of getting to Zion, but he's also talking about it on the personal level when he's talking about his many selves, the parts of us that we don't love, that are hard to love, the parts of us that annoy us. He's talking about bringing those parts to the table and learning to integrate them so that you can achieve Zion both internally and externally. And it's really that practice of learning how to love even when it's difficult.
Right. And so when Jesus says, love your neighbors or your enemies, it sounds to me like from a rhetorical point of view, he isn't saying just lavish love on everyone, be nice to everyone, always open the door for everyone. It sounds like he's saying is doing one of the things that Wayne tells us that we need to be doing to enter into this kind of constructive dialogue, which is starting with assent, which means entering into the mind of the other person. And so when that happens is that you break out of yourself, you break out of your own perceptions, and you get to experience somebody else. And it seems to me that Wayne is really insistent on that. He says, you need to understand that person from the inside. If you're judging that person from the outside at any point, then you're missing the point. You have to first enter into their worldview, and maybe that's what Jesus meant by love your neighbor. It's probably happened to everyone. You're sitting in Sunday school and suddenly you think, wait a minute, I've heard this all before, about 100 times. I'm ready for something new. Well, I'm happy to report that your dream Sunday school class is just a click away at the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Here, you get to hear the best Sunstone articles in an audible quality package. You'll hear about everything, from the first vision to feminism, from LGBT issues to scriptural interpretation, from polygamy to poetry, from scholarship to mysticism, from personal essay to fiction. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. Come join the Sunday school class you wish you had.
I encountered an example yesterday of what I think Wayne would have us do, of the sort of his vision of, I've been using the term critical thinking, and the way Wayne thought of critical thinking was not hyper-rational. It was more holistic, where you're probing each other for common ground, understanding that you're each emotional as well as reasonable, as well as spiritual beings. And it results sometimes in transformation. As I said, I'm teaching a rhetorical theory class, and we've been talking about this dialogical way of influencing. And a student brought in a TED Talk by a woman named Cassie J. It's C-A-S-S-I-E, and her last name is J-A-Y-E. She is a documentary filmmaker. She made several documentary films that are advancing her committed feminism. And she was doing a film on the men's rights movement. I think the title of her talk is, it's Meeting the Enemy. In her preparation for that film, she had about 100 hours of interviews with men's rights activists, people representing some of these men's rights advocacy groups, and interviewed them. And she found herself, as she was listening to them, basically debunking and defending and criticizing everything they said as they said it, and assuming they were all the enemy. But then she went through the process of transcribing 100 hours of that. And through that process, she had to confront her own misconceptions, misperceptions, and their own fundamental decency, and learned they weren't the enemy at all, and learned that that men suffer from some truncation of their rights. And she came away transformed. She even said, I'm not a feminist like I was before anymore. I understand that we're kind of in this together. It was really pretty powerful, and she gives some specific examples of misconceptions that were debunked by her experience, just really listening. The interesting thing is she couldn't listen face-to-face. She was fighting the battle. But it was when she was alone in her room transcribing 100 hours of this that all of this happened to her, and it really was transformation because it really was genuine listening. And what she describes, though she of course doesn't use the term, is that process as a process of probing and finding common ground that was very unexpected. So the enemy wasn't the enemy anymore. We could use more of that.
Right.
We really could. And I actually think that's one of the the main things that I'm kind of hoping to get out of this podcast is how we can use Wayne's methods practically. So it seems to me that we've gone over a few of his main contributions. First, we've identified what he called the modern dogmas, which is, first one is something like, the job of thinking is to doubt. And if you haven't doubted, you haven't thought. And the second one is that values can't be rationalized. These two things pull us toward opposite shores. On one shore, it's we must always be looking for the thing that's wrong with what's going on here. We need to constrict ourselves into more and more hyper-rational structures. And on the other hand, they say, we have these values. They must be defended at all costs, no matter what kind of reasonable or rhetorical outlandishness we need to try. And so those are the two modern dogmas that stop us from being able to talk. And so he talks about starting with assent, which doesn't mean agreeing with the person that you're talking with, but entering into their worldview sincerely and feeling what that feels like, and also seeing what you and your ideas look like through their perception, because then suddenly you can see yourself from outside yourself, which is kind of an amazing experience. You see all kinds of things you wouldn't know. And so that's the process of understanding. And the thing that we haven't quite gotten to yet is the process of overstanding. So understanding involves submitting to the other viewpoint and discerning what this viewpoint considers the proper questions to ask. Overstanding involves asking the improper questions, seeing through, judging, repudiating, transforming, and recreating. In short, appropriating them in inappropriate ways. So what we do is we explore the thing that your conversation partner doesn't intend, but that his or her worldview does allow. What we're doing is we're saying, okay, I've felt and I've dwelt in you, and now let's see what happens when we expand together. And so if you're lucky, you have a conversation partner who is different from you and has loved you in such a way that they understand you from within, and they help you to expand as well.
Yeah, this comes from his book, Critical Understanding. Here's a quote about the relationship between understanding and overstanding. I've sometimes called this the conflict or interrelationship between overstanding and understanding. Understanding being fully succumbing to the work or giving in to temporary suspension of disbelief, as Coleridge called it. After understanding, students should not fail to overstand and apply their own sense of right and wrong and look back on what's happened to them as they read. So in this, that statement suggests the two-part process that he prescribes in The Company We Keep, subtitled An Ethics of Reading, exploring the question, how do we decide what book is ethically or better, really, what he means, morally worth our attention? How do we decide which work of literature to allow ourselves to dwell within in terms of its the moral world it creates for us? And he says, you don't decide that casually. The first thing you do is you dwell in the book long enough to really understand mm-hmm. and experience what the world is. And then you back off and you make a decision. Is this going to be my companion? He talks about books as friends. You can talk about any media this way. You can talk about any people this way, too. Right. Am I going to be in the companionship of this influence now that I understand what the influence is? So it's a reversal of what we usually do, which is we judge a book by its cover and reject or accept. It's going beyond the cover and giving it enough of a try that we can honestly and responsibly make a judgment about whether this is good for us or not. And that sounds like what he means by overstanding. But this gets at an issue in Booth that probably needs some discussion. The book Critical Understanding is making a defense of the attitude of pluralism. That was the prevailing sort of philosophical attitude of the Chicago school that he came out of. And the pluralism is what you do when you can't satisfactorily determine right and wrong. So people who are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are not pluralists in terms of religion if they believe that this is the only true church in the sense that they mean that. But the communities they live in are pluralist because they will allow multiple churches that have that same sort of attitude about themselves. They don't try to resolve that. In the West, we don't try to have a single state-sponsored church. So pluralism can slip into relativism, and that's a difficult problem. What keeps Wayne's work from slipping into relativism is this rhetorology, where he gives the other sides enough attention, enough thoughtful, careful, compassionate attention to come to some understanding. And he has a particular concept of understanding where we really do kind of dwell in that place on a trial basis for a while. And then based on that, we make decisions of exclusion and inclusion. That's when we make our judgments. So what started him on the company we keep is a colleague at the University of Chicago tried to ban Huckleberry Finn from being taught there because of the racist elements, particularly through the character of Jim. And Wayne objected to that, and then he really tried to experiment with what would happen to him when he dwelled in that. And it wasn't until then that he felt like he could overstand that book in a way that could make a decision. And at that point, he quit teaching it.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
Okay, so we've gone through a lot of Wayne's toolbox. We've looked at the modern dogmas. We've talked about starting with assent, going into the other person's mind and dwelling in it. We've talked about understanding and overstanding. And we've also referred a few times to Wayne's many selves model. He talks about himself not as being a unified being, but as being a bunch of different voices inside of himself that are constantly in conflict or in conversation. And the whole point of the book is to come to some sort of plausible harmony. And so that's an interesting metaphor for working within yourself. It's also an interesting metaphor for looking outside yourself and saying, as we were saying earlier, oh, we're all part of what we're hoping will be Zion, which is a group of people who are one in heart. When people get together, their differences are actually a strength. And when we dwell in each other's differences, we can start to talk to each other much better and come together in moments of rhetorology where we understand one another and we start to build our community. We build the cohesiveness of our community, not because we've come to this particular truth and now we all understand it as an abstract concept, but because we have built something unique together that resonates with our community as it is composed by all the people here in this room. Is that about right?
I think so.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm interested now in going into the practical part of this podcast. We've talked a lot about Wayne's thought, about his life. So I still go to Sunday school a lot. I still go to priesthood meeting a lot. And I'm on Facebook a lot. And I'd really like to think about with you guys how we would bring Wayne's ideas into those spaces so that we can commit acts of rhetorology, commit acts of Zion. What is it that we can do?
I could offer a suggestion, and I think it starts with defining the word rhetorology. It comes from the Greek rhetor, which means speaker. So in ancient Greece, at a practical level, rhetoricians were people who taught people how to present their arguments well. And it was the rhetoric is, in that practical sense, is like, how do I persuade you to believe what I believe? Rhetorology is the study of the speakers, where you step back from your argument and your opponent's argument and look at it more objectively, feeling into the heart and sensing into the motivations for yourself and the other person, being more aware of the ego in both yourself and the other person. And so the definition, the study of the speaker, I think really gets to the practice, because once you can get in that state, which is really hard to do in the moment, as Greg said, with the woman who was meeting with the men's rights activists, it's really difficult to do in the moment. Speaking from personal experience, when I'm in the moment and things are heated or I'm overwhelmed with emotion, anger, embarrassment, the possibility of being humiliated, it's really hard to remember to step back from the situation. One practical step is be aware that that is certainly going to happen when you get into disagreement, and expect it to happen. To realize, like, oh, here I go. My ego really wants to defend myself. The act of rhetorology then is being aware of that and saying, okay, wait, I need to calm down. I need to step back and look at these arguments as compassionately as possible.
It's an interesting idea. I like it because it gives you something to do in the moment, to step back and look at what's happening inside of you instead of letting that, I guess, voice start to speak without any of the other voices getting into conversation with it first. You also seem to be implying that if you were more prepared for those kinds of situations, you could encounter them more skillfully. It kind of reminds me of when I would teach gospel doctrine classes. I knew the various personalities in my class, right? And so as I would go through my lesson, thinking about what to bring up, thinking about what questions to ask, the two main things on my mind were, one, what question can I ask that nobody will be able to have an immediate answer to? And the sub-question to that was, if I asked this question, what would Brother So-and-so say? I'm going to have to tweak this question a little bit. What would Sister So-and-so say? I'm going to have to bring it over this way. So it was actually, I would go through all these pre-encounters because I knew who my people were, and I didn't want to bring things up that would just set them off the way that you were talking about. I didn't want to give them easy fodder to talk about their favorite ideas or their favorite interpretations. I wanted to talk about something where we were all just a little bit lost, so that we could sort of accidentally break into, oh, well, I guess we actually need to encounter each other here for a second.
It's really problematical, though. In my experience in Sunday classrooms, those are high-stakes situations with people carrying a lot of baggage in. There are other ways to understand the practice of rhetoric than Wayne's way, which is an idealistic, hopeful way. You know, there's a lot that goes on in human gatherings having to do with display. You display yourself as you want others to see you. You align yourself with particular factions and make sure that alignment is clear. That what Wayne's view of rhetoric is it's very much a face-to-face intimate one.
You're right.
You can do what he talks about in an intimate conversation without an audience to play for. But if you're doing it in a classroom where you decide to be high risk, you just decide on high risk honesty, there are other people in there who are not taking that risk. Mm-hmm. And it can be problematical. As I'm looking at a statement he made late in his life, where he described rhetoric as the art of mediating between your own views and the world, the art of discovering in your circumstances what the possibilities for transformation are. That's a very intimate view of rhetoric, and it plays out, I think, in one-on-one, face-to-face, or very small group relationships. A few years ago, I had to do a talk with a big audience. It was on campus, and I decided to talk about something that I'd been struggling with, and that's fear. And I made the case that in many of our situations in our lives, if not most of them, we have a choice to make between faith and fear. And so theoretically, in a classroom, say I'm sitting there, something comes up, I can make a choice between the fear that keeps me silent or some sort of faith that makes it worth the risk of speaking out, because the faith gives me the capacity to believe that it will turn to some good. I think what Wayne had faith in is the possibility that people, if they were really, could be open and honest and could learn and understand and progress together. And so he would have us take risks in order to make that process possible in the moments that we are present to do that. But it is high risk, and it requires either a great deal of courage so that you're ready to accept the consequences if you are judged and judged harshly, mm-hmm. or you have to trust people. And my experience, that trust develops intimately, not publicly.
And so you don't have a lot of confidence that this kind of rhetorology could happen in your run-of-the-mill Mormon classroom?
I'd like to think it does. It could. And I know that the leaders of the church are trying to set up situations where it can. In a small quorum meeting, I've seen it happen, and I've been willing to take risks. In a gospel doctrine class, or now where the quorum meetings are larger, I'm seeing negative things happen when people take the risk. But, you know, I'm fearful. That's why I've tried to give a talk to correct myself.
Here I come in all idealistic, and Greg's bringing me back down to earth.
Well, that's the thing. Wayne was idealistic, but Wayne didn't go to church.
That's true, too.
Wayne would sit me down, and I think I was church sometimes, and we would talk in these ways, and we would do what he preaches, and we both benefited greatly from it, but we weren't judging each other.
Right.
And we weren't neighbors who had to then go through the week and bump into each other and resolve problems in neighborhoods together.
But it seems like that's exactly what he's talking about in his books, is that we need to be a community of people who do bump into each other, and that these tools should be something we should be able to use. Am I getting too idealistic again? Or?
Well, I don't know. I only know my own experience. My own experience is there are people in my neighborhood and people in my Sunday school class who I am very honest with. Uh-huh. And when I am, they appreciate the honesty, and I appreciate theirs, and we strengthen each other. We help each other through our various little crises of faith. I'm teaching Plato's Phaedrus right now, and he says, you have to know your audience. That's a principle of rhetoric. And he says, you have to know the soul. You have to know your audience intimately in order to really connect and grow together. And Plato says that the whole process is moving each other together closer to the gods. I don't know people I've gone to church with for 30 years that intimately. I know a few, but certainly not everybody. And so the ones that I know, I can do this with. But the ones that I don't, it's risky. There are ways short of full disclosure where you can begin to nurture that. And I've had that happen, where I've nurtured that kind of a relationship over time.
It reminds me of a quote from My Many Selves, where he says about his mission, "It's true that the young hypocrite accomplished little in pursuing his goal of liberalizing the church from within. But he learned how to pray in public in a language that joined the literalists while not violating his own meditations. He learned how to give sermons that woke people up, undermined their cliches, and led them to dwell in the central virtues and limits of Mormonism without leading, most of the time, to angry attacks against him for heterodoxy. He learned how to conduct official funerals without producing annoying and pointless debate about whether there is literal life on the other side. In short, he learned from the Orthodox what was really valuable in their orthodoxy."
That is immensely wise, what he's saying.
Yes.
And it's needed. And I think as you work in a community toward the goals that he articulated, if you're doing that in your congregation, what he just described, you're making giant strides in the direction of what he called, what was it, John, coduction, where just basically common understanding, and Kenneth Burke called it consubstantiality. That is, you're of the same substance. You come to understand each other as one, at least in some aspect. What he's describing there, that's actually what I do in church.
Oh, okay.
But, and actually, I did it when I was bishop. That's kind of what I did. I was honest, always honest, but not fully disclosing everything that wasn't really anybody's business, and also would not be understood or would be misunderstood by many people. And that, what he describes, is really a great gift to a group of people. It falls short of the ideal, the utopia that he describes. But maybe that's okay.
Yeah, because it seems like the major strength of what he's talking about there is that the responsibility is entirely just with you, which is the only person you have control over. And so it kind of sounds like he said, I learned the song of these people, and I learned how to give it different resonances. I learned how to sing their song with my lyrics, or something like that. And that's an act of love, to go in to a people and really learn what it is that resonates with them, and then open it up some more. That seems to be what he was doing. He was putting his own wishes aside in order to expand the world of the people that he loved with very well thought out presentations of what was actually deep inside of him.
There's a sociologist named Brené Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Who made her splash with TED Talk. She's written several books now. She's basically trained in social work, and she is basically a researcher on shame and how shame holds people down. And her work is very, very powerful. I think Wayne would have very much appreciated it. But one of the points she makes is that you have to be careful how much you disclose to people for their own sake, because disclosure, you know, there's the statement of TMI, and sometimes that happens at church. And that kind of disclosure of information to people with whom your relationship is not able to carry that conveyance of information puts a big burden on those people and makes life difficult for those people. That's what she points out. You really need to do the know your audience thing and decide, okay, who can I really say this to without doing TMI in a way that's going to make them uncomfortable around me, going to make them uncomfortable generally. It's certainly not going to be helpful You know, how do you decide what to disclose to whom with the criterion for mutual progress being operative? And that gets, that stuff goes on in church classrooms, the TMI, and people get uncomfortable, and it becomes, people go out sometimes not really very edified because they hear about problems they can't do anything about.
That's still something I'm going to keep thinking about, because I actually have great faith in the Mormon Sunday school classroom. However, I totally agree with you that they are often much too large. My own rule of thumb is that a class should never get larger than 10 people, and that they should sit in a circle so that they can always see each other.
I think that's doable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think then Booth is doable.
Right. Okay, yeah, so agree. Booth is doable in groups of 10 people who are sitting in a circle so that they can see each other's eyes.
And I think that that setting and then laying down ground rules of some kind, saying we're about to experience this, we're going to aim for an experience of learning together. And some people might say things that make you uncomfortable. And the goal here is to be aware of the discomfort. You don't have to agree with the person, but if you're aware of the discomfort and can sit with it rather than just have a knee-jerk reaction, we could get to a place that is really edifying. So it's in addition to everything that you said, I think that some guidance and pointing out about the pitfalls that are going to happen in group dynamics can be really useful, because they will come up. And then people will say, oh, yeah, this is what happens when we're in group dynamics, being vulnerable with each other and being honest with each other. And they're not startled into complete discomfort where it goes off the rails.
Yeah, and John, yeah. I think you just answered Stephen's question about whether this is practical and how we practice it. I hadn't ever thought of that, but, you know, people really don't know what's going on in a Sunday school class. We've all got our own conceptions of what is really happening and for what reasons. And articulating that, articulating expectations, articulating ground rules, asking for their consent, that's really very hopeful. And all you said was basically people need to buy in, but they need to know what they're buying into.
John for Sunday school president.
I will say that it's still extremely difficult, because we are trained to shut down or to lash out when we have these emotions, especially in Mormon culture. And we're trained to be nice, and niceness isn't always honest. And so we have to break free from the notion that says that when we feel discomfort, it's of the devil, which is a misinterpretation in my mind of contention is of the devil, and be okay with experiencing discomfort. That's extremely difficult to do, but that's what happens when you learn to love the just and the unjust. That's the messy process that comes with learning to love your enemy as yourself. And there's a reason why humanity still struggles with this, even though those were the words of Christ 2,000 years ago. And yet, it's the imperative. We have to learn the process of doing that in order to reach Zion.
And I think that Wayne is an interesting sort of analogy for all of this, because Wayne was kind of in the Mormon borderlands. He was going in, going out, and I know that I'm a lot that way too. But the interesting thing about being a borderlander is that you get to see it from a distance, and you get to see how things work, so that you can go back in with that sort of overall map or overall schema of how the machinery works. And you can get in there and do things a little differently, while at the same time knowing what's going on so that you do it skillfully. This is actually one of the things that I think would make the world a much better place, is if we would have more of these borderlanders, these people who have gone through major faith crises, to be like Wayne. What would Wayne do? And come in and expand the song. We really need it, because I've seen so many people, and I was almost one of them, who just leave because there's no nourishment there. They feel all the fear that Greg describes, and they feel like, yeah, if I'm here, I'll be judged. That seems to be what Mormon meetings are about, is here is the judgment criteria. Have we all comported ourselves? Have we all given stories about how we have comported ourselves? Good. Let the values stand. But if instead we were able to talk with each other, to build something more fluid together, to make it our own, then I think we'd retain a lot of these people simply because when they came into these rooms with these people, they would be nourished because they were together, instead of just feeling like this judgment is right. And as long as you're on the right side of that judgment, you feel great. But when you're on the wrong side of that judgment, then suddenly you're out of the community. So that was the reason why I was so interested in doing Wayne Booth with you guys today, was because he was a guy who knows what it's like inside and outside and learned how to mediate between the two. And I just think if we had more Wayne Booths in the church who were like Greg, quietly going around and expanding the dialogue, I think it would do so much more good than any gospel topics essays to just making people want to stay because, hey, here I'm nourished, instead of, hey, here I'm right. And then suddenly you're not right anymore. And you're like, oh my gosh, the only reason I was here was because I was right. I don't know. Am I going too far with that?
Well, one thing that I would add, I don't think you're going too far, but one of the things that I think is characteristic of the attitude Wayne always carried with him is his inherent humility. That is, he, one thing he did doubt systematically was that he was right.
Oh.
You know, we can't make it through life without telling ourselves that we know something. You know, we have to make choices and we have to stand on them. But a better word maybe for humility was that he was perpetually teachable and he was seeking to be taught. And if people would come together with that attitude, his way of envisioning human interaction would probably happen.
Yeah, there's one thought that comes to mind when you say that, and it's a saying in contemporary Buddhism that is, the next Buddha is the Sangha, and the Sangha is the community. And so there's talk, like in Christianity, it's the talk of Christ returning, and Buddhism, it's the idea of the Buddha returning. But then Thich Nhat Hanh and other Buddhist teachers have said that the next Buddha actually isn't a single being, but it's the community. The next Buddha is the Sangha, meaning learning how to be a Zion people might be a way to phrase it. And I find that really, really beautiful.
It kind of feels to me like we've gotten through the plot arc. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I think so.
Is there anything else you guys want to add to what we said?
The reading suggestions.
Oh, yeah, I'd love that.
For general readers, I think The Company We Keep is a wonderful book, and it's accessible, and it's about how you decide what art is a positive influence and what art is a negative influence, and how you make that decision, that self-censorship decision, honestly and responsibly. So he's talking about literature, but it works for films, it works for TV, it actually works for friendships. I think that's maybe his most important book for people who are not academics. His book, Modern Dogma and the Rhetoric of Assent, that's where he articulates his rejection of the dogma of things are wrong until they're proven right, and says we need to consider the possibility that things are right until they're proven wrong. And that came out of his experience trying to mediate as a dean student protests during the post-Vietnam era at the University of Chicago, when he tried to walk out of his office and sit down with the students who had occupied the administration building, and all he got was ranting. He couldn't. There was no talking, no communication, and so I think that's a good book. John, do you have others?
I'll add two other readings. My Many Selves is the autobiography, or what he called life, that we've mentioned.
And oh yeah, it's definitely.
It's in the digital commons, so you can get it for free. Just type in My Many Selves, It's on USU's website now in the Digital Commons, and you can get the, you can see the PDF version of it. It's not in print anymore, so it's a little bit tricky to get. But I'll point to just one section in there. Toward the end, he talks about the moments of his life. As Greg said, he's writing this right at the very, very end of his life, and he makes a list of the moments of his life that matter most. And it's one of the most powerful few pages I've ever read, just because it gets at the heart of what matters in life. So I highly recommend that book. Another reading that I mentioned, which is also online, is about his experiences as an LDS missionary. And the piece is called Confessions of an Aging Hypocritical Ex-Missionary. And it's in Sunstone Magazine. I've read that a number of times, and it's also been really powerful for me.
Yeah, that's definitely in my top five essays of all time. All right, well, thank you so much, both of you, for being with me here today. This actually turned out even better than I thought it would.
And, oh, good.
And yes, that is good.
Hopefully this starts a group of like-minded people who want to go out and quietly inhabit the shoes of other people and expand their worldview, and hopefully stabilize this crazy place a little bit more. That's what I want more than anything.
Yeah, good luck to us all.
All right. Thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate you.